This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
As Patrice may have introduced, I can't recall if Patrice introduced me at the top, but if she didn't, my name is Tyvin Morgenstern. I'm the assistant director of the Carsey Wolf Center. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the first screening of our winter season, and particularly to the first in our feature season or our feature series, Revisiting the Classics, this quarter. And it's also my great pleasure to welcome our guest for the evening, James Keenitz Wilkins, whose latest work, Still Film, we've just had the pleasure of watching. James, welcome. Thank you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We wish you were here in person, but I'm glad you're not stuck in an airport somewhere between Los Angeles and New York. It's better.
Yeah, so. Same here.
So this is a film that we programmed, James, as we were discussing, under our Revisiting the Classics feature series, which it's such a contemporary film and it's so in conversation with contemporary issues. So it might seem a bit strange, but one of the things that drew us to it is that one of the things we wanted to do with this series is think critically about the idea of the classic and about cinematic memory and about how things enter canon. And once they enter canon, how filmmakers such as yourself return to them, adapt them through pastiche or through parody or through critique or through any or remake or reboot or through any number of modes. So when I caught wind of Still Film, I thought it was such an exciting addition to the lineup. So I'm really, really thrilled to be kicking off the winter with this. I think it's such an interesting, we were talking before we jumped on screen, that it in a lot of ways has so many ties directly and indirectly to the rest of the films we're presenting throughout the rest of the quarter. So it's a nice preface and sort of framing device for the rest of what's to come. So the way that I've proposed to move through this conversation is just to sort of ask some sort of really broad questions about what strike me to be some of the key preoccupations or themes or concepts in the film and sort of allow you the ability to sort of openly discuss them, just because I think it's such a dense film that lends itself to so many possible avenues of questioning, and I don't want to narrow it down too much. So if that's all right with you, we'll
absolutely get... yeah,
excellent. So I want to start with a question that is maybe controversial, since it's the subject of so many objections throughout the film, which is the question of form. You adopt this very interesting and peculiar form for the actual playing out of the narrative and of the character development in this film, which is that of the legal deposition. This is a sort of discovery process that's nominally aimed at discovering some kind of factual basis for the ownership or the belonging of this very strange memory of bologna being handed out on a street corner. And so you've adopted this legal frame that's sort of obsessed with the formal ways in which questions are asked and the way that evidence is entered into the record and these sorts of things. And it's a form that you've used many times before in other films and things like Public Hearing from 2012 and Mediums from 2017. So just to begin, I wonder if you could just think aloud about and explain to us what the sort of preoccupation or what your interest is in the legal or the legal framework as a way of asking questions about cinema and about moving images and its significance in the contemporary moment.
Yeah, sure. And that's, thank you for, actually, I will say off the bat, for identifying this accurately as being based on a deposition structure, a deposition being distinct from a trial. I don't really mind, because I love it when people write about the movie, but it has to some degree erroneously been written about as a trial movie. A deposition precedes a trial, and I think is fairly obvious now, maybe to all of you who have just watched it, a process of discovering evidence that may or may not be used within a trial. And what really interested me about a deposition in particular is that there's kind of no authority. There's no boss. There's no judge. it seems like a trial, but a judge is absent. So there's no right or wrong. Excuse me. There's no right or wrong statements. There's just statements, and their rightness or wrongness is determined later. So that openness, I guess, is more attractive to me than specifically a trial. And I actually haven't made, now that I think about it, I haven't made a movie that is exactly a trial. Even Public Hearing was a public meeting, was another evidence finding environment situation. It was a civic meeting about a Walmart expansion. So a Walmart that was being expanded to become a bigger Walmart, and the sort of public commentary, the stage of public comments. And so, not having an authority, I guess. And maybe my relationship to authority as well. I grew up, my parents are lawyers. And so I grew up with this kind of argumentation constantly. And I traffic in it in a way, but at the same time, I sort of have an allergy to it as well. And so maybe I'm always looking for like a way to engage in it without actually fully engaging it.
Right. Well, it seems to me that one of the things that it allows for in the context of this film is a real engagement with problems of language, right? Again, the objection that is raised consistently in this film is not the same kind of objection that gets raised in a trial, which is an objection to the substance of leading the witness, blah, 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 blah. It's specifically object to form. It's right. Objections to the manner in which a question is asked, to the phrasing of a question, to the
It's putting a placeholder that an objection was even made. And beyond that, the judge determines later, maybe if it's reintroduced, right, what its particulars are, let's say. So the purpose for the lawyer is basically to say, like, I just don't like what was said. Or I want to bookmark that this was I want to bookmark that I want to come back to this, basically.
I see.
And actually objection, it's funny because like in a deposition, there's actually less objections that you can like sort of in a sense effectively introduce. And so objective form becomes the dominant one because it's the broadest. It's just saying, I've pinned this as being problematic. sometimes in depositions, the lawyers have flourishes and they get more specific. And within still film, I sort of exercise that license to some degree. But for me, still film is very much it's based on a deposition form. So of course there's this fictional intervention. For me, it's a deposition that goes off the rails.
Right.
I think that was probably abundantly clear.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was very interesting to me the way that the objection to form is so repeated, so consistent, and then does evolve as the film proceeds to be object to narrative, object to fantasy, which raises a whole set of questions in itself, which maybe I'll put a bookmark in for myself and return to later in our conversation. But I did want to ask a question really about your use of language, because if the objective form is really about a way of sort of flagging or pinning an opposition to something problematic, boy, are there problematic things in this film, simply because language is so, even in the context of a legal deposition where language matters so much, what you say matters so much, what gets entered into evidence is significant. The language here is utterly evasive. It's a film that is filled with double entendres and puns and jokes and slippages and homophonic sort of confusions. And I mean, the title of the film is effectively a joke about the form of the film. It is a film made of stills. So it's a still film about film being still. I mean, it's all sort of jokey and punning and circular in a lot of ways. And I found myself thinking about the work of a media scholar named Wendy Chun, who's written about executable language, software language, as sort of the language that lawyers wish was actually language that executes the action that it says it's going to execute. The language in this film is utterly the opposite of that. Any attempt to sort of pin down what is a fact, what is a memory, to put a name to something is constantly coming apart in the course of the conversation between these four characters. And so there's something about the futility of language in this film, and specifically in the legal context, when it comes to describing what media is, what film is, what a memory is. And I wonder if you can sort of just think aloud about that a little bit, about how you approach this question of language and its ability or its inability to wrap around and give a name to our media culture and the kind of cultural work that it does. Like, what is it about the cinematic image and cinematic memory that's so evasive to language?
Yeah, that's a deep package to sort of unwrap. You know, it's funny. On one hand, I agree that the movie's use of language, my use, I guess, by extension, is evasive, but it's also literal, you know? And that's one thing that draws me to puns and sort of homophonic confusion and all of that, as you bring up. Sometimes if something just sounds the way it sounds, it can lead to another sort of mental connection. And it's almost that simple, you know? And it might not be answering the question that was posed, but it's being quite honest to the experience that was had of hearing the word or mishearing the word or something, or mishearing the phrase. And I guess I've been increasingly interested, especially with this movie, and this movie is kind of a proof of concept, with like what it means effectively to just run with associations and to have a kind of run-on experience. The technique, I suppose, of the editing. So I did record each character of the four characters. Each of them is me. And then I edited myself together four times, right? And had this layering. But beyond that, it's not just me talking fast. I tend to talk kind of fast in real life anyways, but I've slightly compressed it. And that's a technique that I was working with, compressed my words and the breaths in between and all of that. It's a technique that I honed in previous shorts. I made a movie called This Action Lies, where I'm analyzing a coffee cup that's cooling on a pedestal, and then another movie called Indefinite Pitch. And I consider these two movies to be the kind of like proto still films in a way, and part of this kind of maybe almost unofficial trilogy at this point. But the thing that they all have in common is that it might be almost impossible, and I'm totally willing to accept this, almost impossible to take all of the spoken language in on its face at once, you know, but that being okay, and trying to create kind of like more like something that's more almost musical maybe, and like a wave that hits you, or rather maybe a wave that you're like constantly like trying to one stroke ahead of and not get consumed by, or one stroke behind and you're constantly consumed, I'm not sure, and being tumbled. But this idea of like processing, smugly like hearing, processing, and being like, I understand the meaning of this, I get this, like, let's move on, you know, that just not being the tempo, and that actually being impossible, and not because the viewer is stupid or I'm smart or anything like that, but just because of an actual physical construction, like it's actually physically impossible, you know, and so what's left is like rocks or objects or things, like you know, buoys to grab onto momentarily, and those have meaning unto themselves, you know, but then you get swept along, and then something else, you hit something, you grab onto something else, and it works, get swept along, it sort of negates that previous thing, and then something else has more meaning. And maybe this is a way, I don't know, I mean, I'm always like, I'm a big proponent of narrative, you know, and I think that maybe puts me at odds to some degree. I'm often categorized as an experimental filmmaker, and I would agree with that, in the sense that like I make things that tend to be experiments. I'm not 100% sure how they'll turn out. I have an idea. But one thing I feel like that's not that associated with experimental filmmakers is a real commitment to kind of beginning, middle, end narrativizing, you know? And I am committed in that way. Like I feel like still film does follow an arc, and it, you know, it's a 72 minute feature. It has this natural progression, but it's also like laterally sort of spastic as well. And I kind of want to have it both ways. You know, it's like, how do you have a forward pushing narrative that also allows you to kind of move where you want to move and lock into associations. And they're not necessarily being like a right or wrong type of experience to have, you know?
Right. And that seems to, that not being the tempo, that kind of impossibility of prizing out the sort of tempo of the dialogue necessarily seems to fit really well with your interest in the deposition as also a place where there is this sort of there's no judge, there's no central authority, simply because in the tempo of the dialogue, it's extremely difficult to tell who's the witness, who's the recordist, which lawyer is which. There, it really decenters the idea that there's somebody questioning and there's somebody answering. It really levels that any assumption of sort of like authority and idea that there's one person steering this conversation.
And that, I think that frankly is at odds with what movies are, which is authoritarian, you know, like they tend, like that I think is the problem with, I love movies, but that's the problem with them is that, you know, you have this locked, baked in situation experience. And sure, you could watch it backwards, you could watch it at 1.5 speed, whatever, but you've still got this limited sort of data set, you know? I don't have an answer for, like, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be that way, but I think maybe it's more like it's multiple desires within myself to be both authoritarian and auteur, dare I say, but then also wanting to open it up, you know?
Right. Well, and I mean, one of the things that's so exciting about the film is that there's, of course, this extremely dense audio track and a very, very complicated sort of dialogue-based narrative in this sense, but there's also this highly ironic and often very comic visual track that's running alongside of it. And so I think of a moment that really highlights a lot of these sort of tensions that you're speaking about. Late in the film, there's a moment when a lawyer at some point seems completely exasperated and stages sort of breaks through and tries to sort of make a claim for deliberative rationality and says, no, we discover facts and we use those facts to adjudicate cases. And he's really making an appeal for a lawyerly sort of rational kind of language-based reason. And then the still that's running over top of this is a still from Get Shorty, which is it's a film about a loan shark and a mobster gaming the film industry through like a B-movie director's, you know, work. So there's this sort of like desperate appeal for some kind of like rationality in the face of cinematic memory, as cinematic memory is like, well, maybe this is all just a scam. There's a really funny way that the tension between the dialogue track and the visual track points these things up for you.
Mm.
Yeah,
the idea of movies as the ultimate scam. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's also why they're so alluring and also have such an impact.
Mm-hmm.
On children too. I mean that's something I think was probably pretty clear. And I guess I'll just say that maybe if it isn't obvious, I'll just come out to be helpful. the selection of slides aligns with my childhood birth through, you know, official technical adulthood. So I was born in 83, and then 2001 is when the last slide. And that also that marks this turning point, obviously a millennial turning point, but also a general shift in photography, you know, from film to analog film to digital being used more, especially more widely in industrial applications, like for still photographers on sets. And so there's this kind of a bunch of transitions happening then. And, you know, now from the age of the ripe middle age of 40, looking back, you know, it's sort of a movie of a 40-year-old talking about the first 18 years of film exposure, and kind of non-consensual film exposure too, to some degree, to talk about authority, you know, and like what, like, and just, I'm trying to loop this back to this idea of like the scam. It's I still, even to this day, I kind of wonder, I'm like, what are movies actually doing? You know, like what are they doing in terms of memory creation, in terms of like what comes out when you're really, really young and you're just excited about seeing anything, what comes out when you're not able to see everything. I mean, I feel like it's a different deal too for, I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a young person these days, but a lot of the movies, all the movies that are cited, were what was available to me within my sort of cocoon, pre-internet cocoon, you know, you know, what was prescribed by Hollywood, basically.
Yeah, well, I think raising this question of childhood is a nice sort of segue to the next set of questions I wanted to ask, which was specifically around the idea of stillness. Because it's a concept that is obviously central to the film. It's in the title. It is central to the aesthetic of the film. It is a film composed entirely of stills. But it's a term that is kind of takes on multiple valences throughout the film, or an idea that takes on multiple valences throughout the film. One of them, I think, has to do with the broader conversation about nostalgia and looking backwards towards firsts, because there's a sense of stillness as stuckness, as inertia, as backward lookingness toward a cinematic past, looking for memories that may exist, may not exist, may have belonged to somebody else and not being quite sure, but not being able to quite let the question go. So there's stillness as inertia. There's obviously stillness as a technical fact of filmmaking that is sort of confused in the course of the film as well. So the film is composed entirely of stills. So it's a film of stills, quite literally a still film, but it is also a digital transfer of stills. So there is a question of whether the film stills are still film. And so it's posing all of these very strange questions about changing technology and the way that the changing technical basis of cinema raises all kinds of uncertainty about where our cultural memories actually reside and what they remain on. And so there's a strange way or an ironic way in which stillness in the film is highly mobile. It's restless. It doesn't stay one thing. It's constantly invoking these different concepts or these different valences. And so beyond it just being sort of like a fun joke in the title relative to the substance of the film, I wonder if you can just sort of help us understand that discourse of stillness that develops across the film and what for you stillness allows you to ask about our relationship between ourselves and our cinematic past.
I mean, I'm not sure if my answer is going to satisfy the breadth of your question, but I would say, like, thinking about residue and just what still remains, you know, and again, like, really, like, mentally and emotionally, like, what is there, is still there, and I guess this connects a little bit to, like, my quote unquote, like, research process for this movie. It just, you know, I worked on this for about 3 years. It's very much a collecting movie. I bought all of these 35 millimeter slides off of eBay and various sources, mostly eBay, not 100% knowing initially that I would turn it into this movie, but then at a certain point realizing that I would, and writing in response to the collecting process. A sort of funny aspect of this is, like, the sort of driving, like, criteria was not to revisit every single one of the movies and rewatch them and, like, be like, oh, I know this through and through. Some of them I actually haven't seen since I first saw them, perhaps when I was 15 years old or something. But I wanted to retain that to some degree. And that kind of, like, fractured, fragmented element or quality where an image, like, I would see an image on eBay and I'd be like, wow, I really remember, forgot about this movie, or I really remember this scene, but I don't remember anything else about this movie. And so what would it mean to reincorporate it into another, like, another movie, and not devoid of its context, but, like, kind of, like, just as it is, as an image, plus whatever association I still have that's survived, I suppose. And that was largely the sort of selection criteria, was the sort of minefield of, it's not random, but the effect may on its face seem random, but it's not, but it's also not comprehensive, you know? And it's not a history of cinema from 1983 and on, or to when I was conceived and on. It is and it isn't at the same time. And it, in a lot of ways, comes down to, like, what survives, you know? And because I'm not an archivist, and so there's this sort of imperfect archive that movies provide in general, but then also these objects that are associated with them that are available, these memorabilia and collector items. But this sort of, like, the stuff that endures, even if it's just simply like a flash of a memory, like, for instance, I actually have, I don't know, I'm not sure how this is going to show up on Zoom, but I thought I'd pull this out for fun. Like, this was used in the movie.
Oh, okay.
Right. So this is a still, this is from
Dick Tracy. Right. Yeah. From
Dick Tracy. Okay. But I remember this image. This is probably one of the guiding image I remember this image from when I was 5 years old. Like that image, I so strongly, like that specific image. And I was very, very, very pleased, to put it lightly, to find, you know, as it's stated in the movie, my 5 year old memory for sale online. And maybe in a sense, all of our memories are online and for sale. We just haven't yet found the, you know, the listing. And there's something both like very perverse about that, but also kind of like freeing and enlightening in a way too, I suppose.
That you could find like, a way to recover it.
Yeah, like recovery is possible. We know it's not, but that it seems possible. And right. The movies, I feel like that's the promise. That's sort of the basis of the scam in a way, or the fraud is that we're like told in a way repeatedly, it's possible. It's possible.
Right. And I think so much of this for me gets condensed in this. There's a portion of dialogue sort of in the center of the film that feels to me really like conceptually kind of the crux, which is this discussion of the unit still photographer, who performs this very specific and very strange, at least in the way it's narrated in the film, kind of labor relative to the films that we end up watching. So I believe it's the witness who is explaining the role of the unit still photographer says things like, these stills have nothing to do with what's been filmed. It just looks like it down to the format 35 millimeter film. And then there's sort of a sort of long digressive-ish explanation of this role. Mm-hmm. And then somebody in the mix says, so the images are basically the same, but basically the same isn't the same. And I sort of feel like that idea of basically the same isn't the same is almost like a thesis for the film, where we're constantly engaging materials that are almost like what we remember, that we're able to find a 35 millimeter still of Breathless Mahoney on eBay. And it's almost like the cinematic memory that you actually have, but basically the same is not the same, right? It's accessible, but because it's accessible as a still, it's not accessible as a film or something.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Like, there's not much more to add to that. Absolutely. And then maybe these sort of added twists where it's like, through the act of making, my relationship to these movies has changed. Through the act of watching, so has yours. You know, if you had one with these movies to begin with, and most people do to some degree. Although there is a real fixed generational thing, and it's been interesting to me to see how this movie has impacted like people who are like within 5 years of my age are like disturbed by it in a way that's different than like Gen Zers have a totally different read, as they should.
Right. Well, I wanted to jump ahead. I could ask a million questions about all of this stuff, but I want to jump ahead a little bit in my script here to ask a question that I really want to ask, which is about conspiracy. Because one of the things you mentioned earlier is that the film itself is sort of an experiment to try and do narrative, but in a way that simply runs with associations. And conspiratorial thinking is maybe nothing other than running with associations.
Yeah.
And assuming that things can be connected to other things in any haphazard way, and that might as well be a structure of truth. So the film is preoccupied, or at least the character of the witness seems preoccupied with conspiracy. Doesn't seem to think of himself as a conspiracy theorist full-blown, but constantly is getting drawn back into contemporary popular conspiracy theories around QAnon and child sex trafficking, and Jeffrey Epstein appears in the film by name, and this kind of contemporary set of conspiracy theories that have emerged since 2016, 2020, around Hollywood as a sex den and these sorts of things, which of course are old conspiracy theories as well. These are not especially new, but they've been newly energized by a conspiratorial internet world. And so I'm interested just to know about what draws you, well, one, to know what draws you so much to conspiratorial thinking, and two, in a film that's really about cinematic memory, is there something about cinematic memory, its partiality, its kind of faultiness, that makes it sort of a right breeding ground for this kind of elaborate conspiratorial thinking, where Tom Hanks is involved in an elaborate conspiracy with the pandemic and with Jeffrey Epstein, and all of these things end up being sort of haphazardly connected? So I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit about what draws you to conspiracy, again, as a way of asking, questions about cinema and its role in our memory making.
I mean, I would say unquestionably, cinema is at the basis. Like, I feel like it's the formative, just sort of material for, it's like the training grounds for the sort of, you know, aspiring conspiracy theorist. Especially the more distance one is from the site of its making, you know, being like people who just aren't affiliated at all with Hollywood, who then have this, it create, you know, this idea of like the parasocial relationship, you know, where you have a one-sided relationship with like a celebrity that you are aware of or see, and you feel like they're, you know them, but you don't, of course. if you don't know them, you don't know them. And I think what really confuses things, and this is just, I'm not saying anything new, are the plots that surround them, which are the plots of movies and the many movies that they're in, and the natural confusion. I feel like no matter how intelligent one is, if you are an emotional being, you know, there's something weirdly persuasive about seeing, you know, you see an actor in a movie playing a bad guy and then a good guy and then whomever, and bits and pieces of that plot is still from that movie, still kind of sticks like a burr. And you know, maybe you are trying, you try not to account for that residue, or maybe that's the point, is that, and that's the way this Hollywood star system works too, right? Is that Tom Hanks has a gloss about him that he carries from movie to movie. That's what makes him marketable as a good guy, because we've seen him already as a good guy a million times. That to me is an active conspiratorial sort of choice in a way, to like build this sort of like meta logic around him, that increases his value in this way. And it doesn't take much imagination, I think, to like flip it or to be like, wait a second, this has been like too consistent. Or as we've seen, you know, with certain characters like Kevin Spacey or whomever, like some of these people that have fallen from grace in the recent years. That's, and again, I agree with you. It's like nothing new. You know, you have like what's his name? Like Fatty Arbuckle or something. You know, I mean, they all, like you go back to like Kenneth Anger's like Hollywood Babylon. I mean, there's always been like Hollywood people are people too. People are people. But I think it's when you have this like magnifying glass and parasocial magnifying glass on people who are also characters, and there's not actually a real consistency except for a market consistency between like the types of roles that they play, you know, we're sort of asked to believe in them as real people, but then asked to believe in them as these infinite other types of people with infinite values, I would say, and behaviors that might contradict each other. And I just think that that's like emotionally confusing. I'm not trying to say like I'm present myself as some sort of emotionally stunted, like I'm unable to watch a movie without like taking it personally, but maybe I am unable. I don't know. Maybe it's all coming to a head.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it also felt to me in the course of the film that it was related somewhat to questions of technology that also get raised as the film unpacks and sort of moves through these sort of jokes and puns around changing technology, simply because I think about the Breathless Mahoney story, which is a story about like an early erotic or sexual memory through cinema that turns out to not have been there at all, yeah. Right? The exposure, the nudity that was imagined was a screen memory entirely. And what allows the character to understand that it's a fabulated memory is the ability to go back to a VHS tape and scrub through it and scrub through it and scrub through it. And it reminded me of the sort of urban legends about, like, you know, when Simba falls down in the dirt in the Lion yep. King, the dust cloud says sex, right? Which is a thing that you can only really do on home video, right? On cassette, is totally. When you gain the sort of vernacular ability to scrub through a film in a really, really close way, it can suddenly become fodder for highly associational and kind of conspiratorial kinds of thinking. It suddenly makes a film a series of keys and codes and these kinds of things.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And the act itself is a sort of like incantation or something too, you know, like this, it really, you know, committed to the act of scrubbing, of finding, of locating, of hunting. But I do feel though the conspiratorial logic, like, you know, it is the language of our time, you know, and I feel like this is why we're dealing with this, like, AI, everyone's freaking out about AI and stuff, which I think is, like, actually nothing to be worried about, but that's a whole nother conversation. But it's sort of like the de rigueur kind of panic of our moment. And it has to do with this, like, you know, like, we just can't trace the source. Like, so everything's the source if nothing's the source, or you can't trace, like, everything must be believed if you can't believe anything, kind of thing. Like, where do we go? Like, how extreme do we go in either direction?
It's funny, you say that, and I remember a line from Krakauer. Krakauer talks about fascist belief as being about a refusal to believe anything and a preparedness to believe anything, or something like that. I know Patrice is in the theater correcting my Krakauer right now, because she would know better. But it's funny, like, I mean, in a moment that's often compared to that, you know, Weimar, like, pre-fascist moment, that also becomes sort of like a ready-to-hand way of explaining our common sense, right? Can't believe anything, yeah. So believe everything, right?
Totally. It's all equal. It's all on the same plane. I mean, I'll say this here. I reveal some of my secrets. Before I actually was going to title the movie Still Film, which it became clear that was a very obvious title to give it. And I do take titles very, very, very seriously. If I struggle with a title, I begin to question the value of the entire movie, to be honest. But I was debating to some degree using the word thin, which doesn't have quite the same ring to it. But thinking about this idea of the thinness, the actual sort of millimeter, like thinness, physical thinness of celluloid, and also just layering of information. And there's this process called like thin film deposition. There's a kind of pun that happens there. But the thinness of information being something that where it's, and it's sort of cited a little bit in the movie, but you know, you can go horizontally in any, like, in infinitely, but still be very, 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 very insubstantial in terms of depth. And so everything's equal, but sort of valueless, you know, when you dig into it.
Yeah, there's a couple of lines where I believe it's a lawyer accusing the witness of swimming in a thin, sticky film and treading, yes, treading an ocean miles wide and millimeters deep, which is perhaps what film is. Anyways, I'm cognizant of time, and I do want to open to any potential questions from down in our theater, but I am going to ask one final question just before we open it up. And it is sort of a broad question or a strange question, but it's a question really about, like, what this film is. It raises all kinds of questions about what film is, but I found that one of the most interesting things about working with it and programming it was the way that the film, outside of what we see on screen, activates a whole set of really interesting problems and questions in the course of programming it. So typically when we program a film here at CARSI, what we will do is we will request a DCP that arrives, and we load it onto the projector, and then we go to you and we say, do you have an electronic press kit with promotional photos that we can use to promote the screening and so forth? And you graciously oblige, and you send me an EPK for your film, Still Film, and what shows up is a series of stills from other films. And it poses a really interesting problem about, like, how do I actually represent this film as something distinct from the films of which it's comprised? Whether on social media or whether in promotional materials or anything like that. It becomes a real representational problem that I think is interesting, and it points to the way that the film is activating a series of things in the actual mechanics of film programming and exhibition and promotion outside of what we're actually seeing in the theater. And so it struck me that while we might see this as part of a body of experimental film work, that it also seems in conversation with other art practices, institutional critique and happenings, and that's my timer, and performance art and other forms of art practice that are about activating relationships and actions and happenings around the text and having that be a part of the work. And so I guess my final question for you is sort of, is Still Film a film? Is it a work of performance art? Is it screen art? How are you approaching the work that the film does on screen and also in the space around it?
That's a lovely question. Thank you for asking it. And I haven't been asked that before. And I think it's actually really astute and important to what I'm trying to do. And, you know, I'm really, really committed to making movies. And I do, it is, I mean, okay, let's knock the word film out for a minute, because what is film? But I actually prefer the term movies. Yes, I mean, for me, it is a movie. It is a movie that's meant to be distributed the way it's you're seeing it, ideally in a theater with an audience, maybe a discussion after like we're doing now, with a beginning and end. I'm actually less inclined towards like installation-based work, or even, you know, we could call it performative, sure, if we want. But that's less my motive, I suppose. But absolutely creating problems for you is a goal. I mean, in the sense that like, these are problems that shouldn't be problems. And that's like a belief of mine in terms of like from a fair use perspective. I would argue in court tomorrow if I had to. Maybe I will at some point, probably not, because I don't think anybody really cares enough, but that it's a fair use usage of these objects, and they are objects because they become objects. Film movies themselves become objects. I think once they're distributed, they become memory-based objects, but then also the detritus that's for sale, as we said earlier, it is and it isn't from the movie. You know, it does not have a relationship, and it begins to take on other associations. You know, when you pay, I mean, this starts to play into like what the questions of like trademark law, like when you buy a can of Coca-Cola, you know, does Coke own the trademark on the can that you bought, and how much of it does it own? Can you then go make a movie where you're drinking a can of Coke? And you see the can that you bought for $1 or $1.25, you know, now you can't represent that in your own movie that you've spent all your money making. You know, there's like all of these issues about representation that I've thought about for a very long time. And I don't have any distinct, like, final answers, because they're basically kind of arbitrary, because it's like the legal system actually is, at the end of the day, kind of about just the sort of common sense. Like, people just sort of decide things that work for a while until they're not, they don't work anymore. You know, like, last thing I'll say is, you know, the song Happy Birth, this is kind of a little bit of a tangent, but for the longest time, there was a group of people who claimed ownership of to the legal rights for the song, the composition of the song Happy Birthday. And they made like $1 million or multiple millions over like many decades, commanding royalties whenever it would show up in a movie. You know, someone would sing Happy Birthday. I'd sing Happy Birthday to you, Tyler. And like suddenly like be in a movie, and we'd have to pay rights to these people. And then that was contested. I think Steve James, the documentary filmmaker, was part of this group that 15 or 20 years ago tried to introduce, challenged it. And I think he used it in Hoop Dreams. And then it turns out that these people had no right to do this, according to like today's logic, and had been bamboozling people with money for decades, because they just made a claim that they owned something that belongs to all of us. And, you know, part of fair use too is assessing whether something is in competition with the bigger thing. And, you know, there's no way that still film is in competition with any of the movies you're going to show next week or the week after or whatever.
Don't sell yourself short.
They relate. But it's part of a conversation. And so like, I'm really interested in making movies that are part of a conversation. And that's my goal at the end of the day.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so delighted that we were able to bring this film to UCSB. And I spent a lot of time this holiday watching this, and I loved it every time, even though it made my head spin. So thank you so much for sharing it with us. Thank you for joining us, albeit virtually. I do hope that we get to bring you out here in person sometime in the future for another of your works. But it's been a delight to chat with you. So thank you so much for your time.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks everyone for checking the movie out, and enjoy what's coming the next month or two.
All right. Thanks, James, so much.
Thanks, Todd. Okay. Bye.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.